Hello, it's John Dennis on Tuesday, December the 9th. Today, Europe divided on how to respond to the global economic crisis and to the challenge of global warming.
Now, the Germans are a big problem here. Going into recession and facing the economic crisis, they think it's extremely bad timing when people are losing their jobs, when the economy is going through the floor. The kind of measures that are required, they think, will just make matters worse.
Five suspects in the 9/11 attacks on America plead guilty at a military court at Guantanamo Bay.
There's a sense among these detainees that there is no difference between the defense lawyers, the Bush administration, and everyone else, that they do not really trust this whole process and don't want to carry on with it anymore.
And inspired by a roulette wheel, the Turner Prize-winning artist Keith Tyson gives his art away for free today.
I really want to draw a correlation between what's going on in the financial world at the moment and in terms of capitalism and these systems that are going that seem a little like a casino.
Guardian Daily with John Dennis on guardian.co.uk.
Before we hear about any of that, let's go to Sandy Waugh, who's got the news headlines and the papers.
Greece has experienced a third night of rioting by youths in several cities. In Athens, they burned down a massive Christmas tree in a central square. In other cities across the country, shops, banks and cars were set on fire. The government held an emergency cabinet meeting. The interior minister said afterwards that police would take a firmer hand to control the rioting. Today, there'll be the funeral of a teenage boy shot dead by police that sparked the riots. In San Diego, California, a fighter jet has crashed on a suburban neighborhood, killing three people. The F-18 jet was returning to a Marine base after a training exercise when it crashed in flames after the pilot ejected. A military court in Guantanamo Bay has been thrown into confusion by the alleged mastermind of the 9/11 attacks pleading guilty. The judge has called on specialist lawyers to advise him on whether he can then apply the death penalty. Khalid Sheikh Mohammed dismissed his lawyer and said that he and four others wanted to plead guilty and confess. The judge said he was not sure if he had to convene a military panel to carry out a death penalty. We'll have more on this story later in Guardian Daily. Congress has sent a draft rescue plan for the US car industry to President Bush, but they've only offered half what the big three car companies were asking as a bridging loan, $15 billion. It would mean the government would own shares in the companies. The White House gave a cool reaction, saying it wanted to ensure the companies were viable. There's a wide range of stories on the front pages of the papers. Good news from The Express, which says that a tank of petrol is now £18 cheaper than it was in the summer. Even diesel has now gone down below a pound a litre. Bad news from the Financial Times, which warns the recession is hitting pension funds so hard that the losses could swamp the government scheme to guarantee pensions for millions of people. The Independent reports what it calls the great credit card scandal. The paper says that credit card companies face an investigation by competition watchdogs. The Telegraph's expecting many middle-class professionals are going to be thrown out of work by the recession. It suggests they will be helped by government money to study for new qualifications. One story that several papers carry is the sudden resignation of David Ross, a co-founder of the very successful Carphone warehouse. As The Times and The Guardian explain it, it emerged that he had broken city rules by borrowing millions of pounds with his shares as the guarantee. The Guardian also reports that NATO countries fighting in Afghanistan are desperately looking for new supply lines after militants destroyed more than 100 vehicles in Pakistan. And on the sports pages, several papers headline Harry Redknapp's Tottenham beating West Ham 2-0. In the Mirror, the star was Ledley King, who headed in his first goal in 3 years. Others look at the England cricket team's return to India for the Test series. Team spirit drove us back to India, says Flintoff, reports The Guardian. More on the day's news and breaking stories at guardian.co.uk.
Nicolas Sarkozy, the French president and currently the acting European Union president, and José Manuel Barroso, the head of the European Commission, met Gordon Brown at Downing Street yesterday to discuss the European response to the global financial crisis. It was an informal summit, but a notable absentee was Angela Merkel. Our Europe editor Ian Traynor is in Brussels. He explained why the German Chancellor objects to Gordon Brown's plans for a stimulus package.
Angela Merkel, the German Chancellor, who, I mean, against a lot of domestic opposition, is refusing to come up with the kind of stimulus package that particularly the British are supporting. The European Commission, José Manuel Barroso, who was at Downing Street yesterday along with President Sarkozy of France. Certainly Barroso and the Prime Minister Brown are reading from the same hymn sheet here. Merkel obviously does not see that as the way forward. She faces different economic problems at home. The German economy operates quite differently from the British. And most pertinently, she doesn't see tax cuts and VAT cuts as the answer to this crisis. And that very much goes against the thinking at Downing Street and from Alistair Darling in his pre-budget report a couple of weeks ago, which was obviously cutting VAT and looking for Britain pre-Christmas kind of shopping spree to kind of shop the way out of the recession. That's certainly not the way the Germans see it. I mean, if you look at it's a kind of cultural difference, really. I mean, if you look at the way the Germans consume and the way they make things, German household saving rates, and the latest figures that I've seen are 5 or 6 times that of Britain and America, for that matter. In other words, Merkel takes the view that if you cut taxes, the Germans are just going to pocket the money, put it in the bank, and that is not going to provide any economic stimulus whatsoever. And that's basically the cultural difference between the two.
There's also a difference of opinion on tackling climate change.
Yes, absolutely. We're heading up to quite a major European summit this Thursday and Friday, and possibly going into Saturday in Brussels, at which the EU's 27 national leaders are supposed to finally agree, after almost 2 years, finally agree on 4 pieces of legislation that would make this big climate change package law, make it mandatory. Now, the Germans are a big problem here. Going into the recession and facing the economic crisis, they think it's extremely bad timing when people are losing their jobs, when the economy is going through the floor. The kind of measures that are required, they think, will just make matters worse. And it's unfortunate timing, but they're taking the view that, you know, jobs are more important than CO2 emissions. And on several of the key aspects of the plans that are on the table, they've got big problems with, particularly because of the big heavy industries in Germany, which are very, very energy intensive, and they want them to be exempted or excluded from some of the provisions that are key to the success of this. Again, the British are actually quite keen on having as ambitious a package passed as possible in order to send a strong signal, mainly to the Obama administration in the States coming into office, but also to the Chinese and the Indians, with a view to the year coming up of global climate change negotiations culminating in Copenhagen next December.
These are disagreements on very fundamental issues. I mean, is there a way forward for European unity?
Well, the way forward for European unity at the moment is really a la carte. It's not unity at all. It's basically letting pretty much, certainly the big countries, the French, the Italians, the Germans, the British, not exactly go their own way, but do what they're going to do anyway, and then pull it all together here at headquarters in Brussels, package it all together and dress it up as the European Union's response. In other words, this economic package that's on the table is called the European Recovery Plan. Well, it's not really a European recovery plan at all. It's a number of national attempts at recovery or at financial and economic stimulus that is being basically repackaged together and dressed up as a European plan after the event. For the moment, I would say that the fundamental interests and differences in perception are just too big. Over time, perhaps things will level out. I wouldn't call it that there's going to be any fundamental split that long-lasting in the European Union over this. But basically, there will be an agreement to let people do their own thing as they see fit and as their national economies require.
Ian Traynor in Brussels. As politicians around the world prepared to head for Poznan in Poland for crucial talks on climate change, yesterday London's Stansted Airport was thrown into chaos by environment campaigners. Activists from the Plain Stupid group caused dozens of flights to be cancelled when they occupied a secure area. They were protesting against plans for a second runway. 57 people were arrested. John Vidal, our environment editor, says that from the demonstrators' point of view, it was a success.
I think so, yeah. I mean, the whole point of Plain Stupid is to raise awareness of climate change and to get angry, to be visibly angry at government for taking no political action to reduce climate change emissions. So this was interesting because it was one of their largest operations, 50-odd more people going in there, and it got very good coverage. And so, yes, in their terms, it was a great success.
Who are Plain Stupid?
Very interesting. Set up 3 years ago, 2005, by a bunch of university students. It's just grown out of all proportion. And very quietly, it's just got into the campuses. A lot of graduates. Most people, it doesn't have members. It's like a network of anybody who's interested in reducing climate change emissions can use the name if they're taking direct action about aviation. And so I'd say there's probably 200 or 300 people who have used the name Plain Stupid in Britain at the moment. But as one of them was saying to me today, I mean, you know, something like this gets on the front pages, gets on telly, and they are going to get more and more and more. And there's a real parallel going on with this and the anti-roads movement of the 1990s. And it is growing exponentially, but especially in the sort of scientifically literate university campuses and colleges of education. Where, and it's seen as a really sort of sexy thing to do.
And Ed Miliband, the Environment Secretary, calling in only on Monday for a mass movement to galvanise leaders for climate change.
It's a fantastic timing. I'm pretty sure that he was there himself, but undercover, as it were. Yeah, I mean, he is quite rightly identified the fact that if you are going to have major change, it needs to be personal change, and you do need a mass movement. And then lo and behold, within hours, he's got the vanguard of this movement out there and, you know, doing the business.
And the timing of it, obviously, before Poznan this week, where ministers are flying out tomorrow to discuss a successor to the Kyoto Protocol.
Absolutely right. Timing absolutely brilliant in two ways, because it was, you know, here's the thing about global warming, and it was one of the coldest mornings of the year, and also the major UN climate talks in Poznan, which today had a day off. The ministers turn up on Wednesday. They've got one heck of a lot to get through, and there's already talk of it, it's stretching into Saturday now. Three major blocks are immediately emerging. The America has turned up with the Bush team, and in other words, the old thinking. And they're just playing a very, very low profile, but it means that nothing can go ahead. And Europe has got itself into a right mess with a lot of infighting between countries like Italy and Poland objecting to Europe's 2020 targets, and countries like Britain and France trying to keep it on track. So infighting there. And secondly, Europe cannot decide and will not decide how the whole thing, how the major parts should be funded. And so any decision on funding is now being deferred till March or April next year. The result is almost certainly, you know, we will get some kind of statement, but it'll be a very, very low-key thing, I fear, at the moment.
How's the science on climate change changed since Kyoto?
Well, it's a pretty bleak subject in the sense that there's nothing really which suggests it's going to get any better. That all the indicators suggest warming, accelerating, more threats from climate systems, which are sort of feed-in systems and whatever. It's not looking good. Scientifically, the consensus now is terribly strong that not only is it happening and taking place, it's going to be much worse than we thought. And if there is action to be taken, then it has to be done very quickly to keep it at a reasonable level. In other words, something like 2 degrees centigrade rise over the next 80, 90 years, as opposed to 4 or 6 degrees, which is effectively a disaster, a catastrophe of the first order. So the science at the moment is looking very bleak indeed.
John, many thanks. John Vidal, and you can find the latest on the Poznan talks at guardian.co.uk/environment. Also on The Guardian's website today, what kind of mayor is Boris Johnson shaping up to be? Andy Beckett investigates at guardian.co.uk/politics. Kat Christopher argues that the Greek government is reaping the reward of years of corruption and neglect with the current riots. guardian.co.uk/world to read that one. And Jonathan Jones, our art critic, on the betrayal of the Barcelona architect Antoni Gaudi's religious masterpiece Sagrada Familia at guardian.co.uk/arts. Five men have told a military judge at a war crimes tribunal at Guantanamo Bay that they want to confess to plotting the September the 11th attacks. Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, the alleged ringleader, told the judge he had no faith in him, his Pentagon-appointed lawyers, or the American President George Bush. If found guilty, the men face the death penalty. Suzanne Goldenberg is in Washington for The Guardian.
Well, there's five people who were in the court yesterday, and the best known among them is Khalid Sheikh Mohammed. He's a sort of alleged mastermind of the 9/11 attack. And this was meant to be the last big hearing of the Bush era, if you like, but it was thrown into chaos yet again when Khalid Sheikh Mohammed and the others said that they wanted to plead guilty.
Why did they do that?
Well, I think that they are hoping to get a platform to be able to talk about why they carried out the attacks they are accused of being involved in. I think also there's a sense among these detainees, you know, are accused of being part of Al-Qaeda, that there is no difference between the defense lawyers, the Bush administration, everyone else, that they do not really trust this whole process and that, you know, they just don't want to carry on with it anymore.
Is it a genuine admission of guilt in the September 11 attacks, or is it really, you know, a bid for martyrdom?
Well, three of the detainees have previously pleaded guilty to the attacks. Now, the question is, normally when people plead guilty, they're not given the death penalty. So it's not clear, you know, whether this would be sort of allowing them to claim martyrdom. But I think sort of precipitating factor for all of this is the idea that Barack Obama is going to become president in a little more than 40 days. That could change the whole nature of Guantanamo. And I think, you know, that the idea of that has sort of prompted this action.
Obama opposes these military trials at Guantanamo. Do we know what he's going to do about them?
It's not yet clear how Barack Obama is going to go about dismantling Guantanamo. And by that I mean the whole legal apparatus, not just the prison camp. You know, there is a very big question mark about what to do about the 250 people who are at Guantanamo, who include the sort of well-known, high-profile detainees like Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, who's in the courtroom now, as well as, you know, more anonymous people. And I think what's happening in the Obama transition team is that they are looking at their options. They are not going to go down the road of having these military commissions that the Bush administration has used and have been almost universally discredited, but they aren't clear yet on whether they're going to try them in federal civilian courts or use military law or indeed come up with a new kind of legal proceeding.
Suzanne Goldenberg in Washington. I'm John Dennis. Still to come on Guardian Daily, one of America's biggest media companies is on the verge of bankruptcy.
There was a report out last week that predicted by 2010 several entire cities in America would have no newspaper.
But first, an alleged mastermind of last month's terrorist attacks on Mumbai is reportedly being held by Pakistani security forces. 171 people died in a three-day siege of Mumbai, India's commercial capital. The man believed to have orchestrated the assault, Zaki-ur-Rehman Lakhvi, was among a dozen people arrested in a raid on a militant camp in Pakistani Kashmir. In Islamabad, for The Guardian, is Saeed Shah.
What we do know is that it happened. The Pakistani authorities have acknowledged that it happened. They acknowledge that people have been arrested, but they haven't named who. So the fact that the names of the people arrested, or at least some of them, one is getting from other sources. And, you know, it's very hard to confirm anything, you know, because people have a vested interest in giving the impression that Pakistan is cracking down on militants, is arresting people. Whether or not these people really have been arrested and what's become of them is very hard to determine.
So it could be just a gesture by Pakistan rather than anything of any real substance.
Well, I think it's more than a gesture. It's certainly what one Indian official described to me as a good first move. But the thing is, are these people arrested? I mean, what's going to happen to them? I mean, are they going to be put on trial? Are they going to be handed over to India? And is this raid going to be followed up by other raids?
And the background to this, Saeed, is that the Pakistani security services are very much linked with Lashkar-e-Taiba.
Well, there is. I mean, obviously the intelligence services in Pakistan, the main one being the ISI, will never acknowledge that. But I think it's pretty well established from other sources that there has been a long history of association between the ISI and militant groups. And they were used really to fight a sort of proxy war with India in Kashmir and elsewhere.
There have been reports that one of the people who have been arrested this week is Zaki-ur-Rehman Lakhvi, the alleged mastermind of the assault on Mumbai last month. Do we know very much about him?
Well, not a huge amount. I mean, he's supposed to be the operations chief of Lashkar-e-Taiba. And so he's, in sort of military terms, he's the key commander there. He's also supposed to be the one that recruited Ajmal Amir Kassab, the lone gunman who has been caught by the Indian authorities. So he's an important player, but he's not the only one that India is seeking, and not the only one who was involved in sort of masterminding and overseeing this operation.
Saeed Shah. Keith Tyson, the Turner Prize-winning artist, is giving 5,000 original artworks away for free from midday today. And to do so, he's harnessed the power of the internet, and he's been inspired by a roulette wheel.
It's a limited edition of prints, which are created by the computer generating random numbers between 1 and 37. As in a roulette wheel, if zero comes up, then it's a green stripe, and if it's one or three, then it's a red stripe, or 8 or 17, etc. It's a black stripe. And although this is a very simple device, there's billions of different combinations that can be generated by it. And what's interesting for me is to create something which is using these chance systems and your location to posit an artwork that looks a little bit like a modernist abstract painting, but it's just a consequence of a mathematical system.
Why a roulette wheel?
I think the body of work that it comes from was about the notion of history paintings, and history paintings are painted from either the position of a defender or of the a victor in some kind of battle, and in a roulette wheel there's just the sort of non-emotional red, black, black, red going on. And if you're invested in one particular colour turning up, then you'll be elated. And if the other colour comes up, then you'll have lost and you'll feel dejected. And I really like to draw a correlation between what's going on in the financial world at the moment and in terms of capitalism and these systems that are going that seem a little like a casino. And history painting and the idea of human security, emotion and history. So roulette wheels for me have this other connotation of the spin of a wheel being something like the outrageous fortunes of the social system.
And what gave you the idea to sort of use the internet and the possibilities of the web to make art?
Well, I think that, there are a lot of online casinos, for instance, at the moment that are out there and people in investing in this kind of thing. And my work's always been involved with the concept of interconnectedness and rhizomic structures. And the web is, of course, a sort of physical manifestation of that in the virtual realm. It's all the information and knowledge and inputs and outputs and locations all kind of interacting and interfering with each other in a big information system. And I originally made a lot of work to do with computers early on. I built an art machine and I did some web-based stuff. And I think it was maybe a little ahead of its time because the internet was pretty fledgling. So now I'm trying to sort of return to that.
So today at midday, Guardian readers and listeners to this podcast will be able to get their hands on this piece of artwork. What do they have to do to get it?
If they go online and they go to the website, there's a whole series of various projects that I've done over the years, and this one is called the History Paintings. If you go onto that particular planet that's spinning around, and there'll be links that allow you to print your own self-generated history painting. when you go onto that particular page, it'll ask you to input your location, it'll generate a serial number based on your ISP address, and then it'll print out a unique file for you, or it'll give you a unique file. You can then take that off to the printers, and as long as you print it according to the instructions, you'll have your own Keith Tyson original artwork.
Keith Tyson, and to get that free work of art, go to keithtyson.com from midday today. A financial crisis is threatening the future of two major newspapers, the Chicago Tribune and the Los Angeles Times. The paper's owner, the Tribune Company, is weighed down with $13 billion of debt. It's now discussing bankruptcy. With the details is our New York correspondent, Ed Pilkington.
Well, a couple of things, really. Specifically, the Tribune companies is under a huge mountain of debt, something like $13 billion of debt, because its controversial chairman, who grabbed power within the company last year, in December took it private. It was a huge deal, cost $8 billion, and as I say, it's now created the company with an albatross around its neck of massive debt. But in a wider sense, what's happening to the Tribune Company is really just symptomatic of the struggle and the trouble that is going on right across America, coast to coast, for newspapers in this country, many of which are now really struggling to keep their cash flow going and are in danger of defaulting on their debts and could even go bust. There was a report out last week that predicted by 2010 several entire cities in America would have no newspaper. Remember that a lot of these cities have monopoly newspapers with just one newspaper in town, and a lot of the people in those cities get most of their information from these newspapers. So the prospect of entire cities being without a newspaper in America is one that's very, very chilling for a lot of people here.
And is that the case for Chicago and Los Angeles? You know, the Tribune, Chicago Tribune and the Los Angeles Times being the two biggest titles owned by Tribune Company.
The group now being in deep trouble obviously raises questions about the LA Times and Chicago Tribune, two of the most famous and venerated titles in American history, really. I don't think anyone expects those titles to disappear entirely, but bear in mind that both of them have already been slashed very, very heavily over many years now. The LA Times has a newsroom that is barely half the size that it used to have only a few years ago. And the same would apply to the Chicago Tribune. Senior reporters have been sacked, sections have been closed. They're very, very thin, these papers now, compared with what they used to be. And there's a feeling abroad that the sort of service, information service that Americans are getting from their newspapers, which many people feel is absolutely crucial to sustaining democracy in this country, has already been whittled down. It's still alive, but it's kind of barely the animal that it used to be.
Ed Pilkington. Today's edition of Guardian Daily was produced by Phil Maynard and Tim Mabey. I'm John Dennis. Thanks for listening.